The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Okay, well, in the Catholic tradition, there have been, at times, various authors and saints who have cast suspicion on study, have attempted to diminish its role in the Christian life, or have cautioned that it is often tightly connected with profound temptations, such as pride. Knowledge puffs up, after all, as St. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. In the book, The Imitation of Christ, for example, the first chapter contains the biting remark, "I would rather feel compunction than know how to define it." Gregory the Great, in his dialogues, holds up a certain priest named Sanctulus as a model for holiness. But part of what made Sanctulus so holy was that he was not very book smart. Therefore, his mind couldn't get in the way of his heart. Gregory, who was himself a very learned man, writes with a certain embarrassment, quote, "We know for certain that Sanctulus was not well-versed in literary studies, nor did he know the precepts of the law. But because love of neighbor fulfills all the demands of the law, he kept the law in its entirety by his love of God and neighbor. Knowledge that he did not receive through formal study became a living force within him through love. Sanctulus had a practical rather than a theoretical knowledge of this precept. Let us compare, if you will, his wise ignorance with our unwise learning. Our learning lies low, whereas his wisdom rises high. We speak of virtue while we are devoid of it ourselves. We take our stand in the midst of fruit-bearing trees to enjoy their pleasant fragrance, but we do not eat of their fruit. Sanctulus, on the contrary, knew how to gather the fruits of virtue, even though he may not have sensed their sweetness exhaled through the written word." St. Bonaventure, in his Journey of the Mind to God, also warns his readers that we arrive at the perfection of our mind through prayer and through the blood of Christ crucified. Without these firmly rooted in our lives, he says, quote, "We may come to think that mere reading will suffice without fervor, speculation without devotion, investigation without admiration, observation without exaltation, industry without piety, knowledge without love, understanding without humility, study without divine grace." These remarks have a certain force to them, and perhaps they might resonate a little bit with us who are fans of St. Thomas Aquinas, patron of university students, who are engaged at one of the greatest hubs in the world for study and for research. Now, in this talk, I want to stress that while there is great truth contained in all of those warnings about study, St. Thomas Aquinas, on the other hand, can give us an approach that actually locates study at the very heart of the moral life, at some of the most important aspects of who we are. It is not because it is bad that we should be cautious about it, but precisely because it is so good that we should have great care in cultivating it in all of its different forms. Study, for St. Thomas, is actually a vast concept, much broader than when we think of studies such as like doing homework or preparing for exams or doing research. Just looking at the Latin origin, the word studium or the verb studere has a much wider range of meaning than it does in English. Beyond what we think of study in the formal academic sense, studium evokes an attitude of zeal, an attitude of eagerness, of effort and application and exertion towards a definite end, specifically an end that is desirable, that brings delight or some sense of accomplishment in its attainment. Studium expresses both the goal and the endeavor undertaken towards the goal. That's all of your studium. The ancient writer Sallust, for example, writes this. He says, "All men who study to excel other animals ought to strive with the utmost effort, lest they pass their lives in silence like cattle." Sallust, okay, he's got a bit of a style, okay? So do you hear that sense of effort in there? Do you hear that sense of seeking for something? That's kind of what we're getting at when we're talking about studium in Latin. And that's crucial to the larger sense of study that we'll see in St. Thomas. So say you really wanted to get good at like baking, okay? Your study would not only be, you know, finally having the delight of making a really good, buttery, flaky croissant, okay? But it would be all the times that you practiced making a croissant, okay? It would be your consulting of different recipes, of trying out different techniques, of, you know, exploring different ingredients, of having your roommate be your guinea pig, like, "Hey, bro, taste this," okay? It would be just thinking about croissants, okay? That's all study. Your study is being eager for something in its final stage and every step along the way. In St. Thomas, study is a word that appears in the majority of his works. Okay, it's like there are very few works that don't include like the mention of the word study in one of its forms. So just to limit ourselves a bit, in the following, I'm going to highlight three places where study is important in what's called the secunda secunde, the second part of the second part of the Summa Theologiae, the Summa, the big work, okay? Now, as a refresher, or for those new to St. Thomas, the second part of the second part is the part of the Summa where Aquinas is going to look at the components of your moral life in granular detail, okay? So the moral life is not just simply a list of do's and don'ts, as important as those are, but it's a description of how the human person made in the image of God moves towards him as his or her ultimate happiness. The second part of the second part is going to look at all of the little parts that go into making that progress towards happiness a reality. Specifically, those perfections that can accrue to a person that contribute not only to warding off sin, but to actually increased momentum on your journey, such as the virtues, the gifts and fruits of the Holy Spirit, the Beatitudes, and various forms of participation in the life of the church. The second part of the second part has the highest concentration of uses of the word study out of all the works of St. Thomas Aquinas, by far. Okay? I checked. So this is a good place to focus on if we want to understand what study has to say to us about our moral life, about what does it mean to be a good person? How do we become happy? So we'll look at three places in the second part of the second part, unless there are any objections. Okay, we're going to move on. Good. So the first and perhaps most important place where study makes its appearance is when Aquinas discusses the theological virtue of charity. Specifically, question 24, article 9. Now, before diving right in, it's good to realize that charity for St. Thomas is kind of like the hokey pokey. It's what it's all about. If the point of life is to be united with God in happiness, then charity is essential because it is precisely that by which we are united to God in loving friendship, founded upon God's own gift of himself to us in grace. Aquinas writes elsewhere, quote, "The spiritual life consists principally in charity, for he who is without charity is reputed to be spiritually nothing." Nihil. Hence, the apostle, Paul, says, "If I should have all prophecy and should know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I should have all faith so that I could move mountains and have not charity, I am." And the blessed apostle John asserts that the whole of the spiritual life consists in this love. "We know," he writes, "that we have passed from death to life, because we love the brethren. He that does not abide in love abides in death." The spiritual life is not about creating meaning in our life. It's not about practices that cultivate unique, esoteric experiences. It's not about achieving serenity. It's about loving the Lord our God with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength, and our neighbor as ourself. To have charity is the greatest success. To lack it is the greatest failure, no matter what else we do or what good we produce. Nor is charity identical with love. All charity is love, but not all love is charity. It's helpful to realize that the word love is a term expressive of a whole genus of things. There are many species of love that fall under this umbrella. In that sense, the word love is kind of like our word dessert. Okay? So, who here can name a dessert?
Chocolate cake.
Chocolate cake. What's another one?
Just ice cream.
Ice cream.
Those are the only
just say things. Yeah, it's okay. Chocolate. Okay, chocolate cake, ice cream. What else?
Cookies.
What?
Frozen yogurt.
Pie.
Fruit.
Someone just desserts. We'll fall that under analogical use. Okay, we'll put it. Yeah, very good. Yeah. What? Creme brulee. Yeah, very good. Okay, we got a good list here. Now notice, those are all desserts, right? Now notice, some desserts are hot. Are all desserts hot? No. Some desserts are cold. Some desserts are solid. Are all desserts solid? No, some are liquid. Some are very liquid. Okay? Some desserts are very simple. Fruit. Some are very complicated. I don't know how to brulee a creme in the first place. But notice, all of those things are different, and sometimes they have opposing characteristics, hot and cold, right? Liquid, solid, complex, simple. And yet all of those, in one way or another, what do they fall under the umbrella term of? Dessert. What makes it so? Well, all of those things, as different as they are, have one thing in common, is that dessert, in order for it to be a dessert, have to be sweet. Right? So, in a similar way, something applies to the word love. There are many species of love that in just humans alone can be very diverse. There can be ordered love, disordered love, virtuous love, sinful love, intellectual love, bodily love, natural love, supernatural love. But what do all those different things have in common? What they all have in common is, in one way or another, love involves a perception of goodness. We do not love a thing in any sense, except insofar as it appears to be something good to us in one way or another. Love involves the perception of goodness. Charity, however, is a very, very specific kind of love. It is an intellectual love insofar as not something that we feel with our body. It takes place in our will, the desiring function of our mind, in the act of knowing what's good. It is not natural, but supernatural, insofar as it is something that can only come about because of God's infusion of sanctifying grace, of allowing us a participation in his own life and beatitude. Charity is a divine, a supernatural love in the will, whereby we are granted a perception of the goodness of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, not distant from us, but as dwelling imminently within the very operations of our souls. He who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. And in that kind of love, there is a salvific, beatifying friendship. I no longer call you servants, but my friends, says Christ. That friendship is charity. Importantly, the perfection of the Christian life consists in nothing else but that charity. St. Thomas writes this: a thing is said to be perfect insofar as it attains its proper end. But charity is that which unites us to God, who is the ultimate end of the human mind. Since he that remains in charity remains in God, and God in him. And therefore, the perfection of the Christian life follows specifically according to charity. Now, notice that Aquinas refers here to God as the ultimate end of the human mind. Now, this is where we can finally go and look at question 24, article 9. In question 24, St. Thomas is looking at charity, not as a disembodied idea, but specifically as instantiated in us, in our wills, as something perfective of our mind's ability to perceive goodness. This question, as Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange comments, is of the greatest importance to our spiritual life. Article 1 of this question establishes that charity is specifically in the will. It's not in your liver, for example. Okay, it's in your will. Articles 2 and 3 establish that charity is not something that we are naturally born with or capable of acquiring on our own based on our good looks or talent. It is a sheer gift that God infuses into us according to his wise plan of providence and predestination. But charity is not something inert or static. It isn't just a nice little decoration like a doily in your soul, okay? It's something dynamic. Articles 4 through 9 explain how charity can increase. It can become more intense within us. Articles 10 through 12 explain, sadly, that charity can also diminish and why one mortal sin extinguishes it. So, Article 9 of Question 24 is the climax of Aquinas' account of how charity can increase in us. And it is right here that study appears. That was all a warm-up for this. Okay. Now, following a venerable tradition, Aquinas delineates in this article three grades, three stages, three degrees of the spiritual life. What differentiates one grade from another is not how old you are, it's not your CV, it's not your family, your connections, your GPA, your emotional health or income, it's not the reach of your LinkedIn profile. It is what, in charity, you study. What does he mean by that? Now, by this, he doesn't mean something like beginners in the spiritual life study English literature. More advanced people study engineering. And the most enlightened Christians study economics. Remember, study has the sense of pursuit, the sense of effort, the sense of seeking. What you are seeking in the spiritual life is indicative of how thoroughly charity has transformed you into a friend of God. What are you seeking? But there is an inner logic to how charity grows that establishes a fairly precise order by which one progresses through each of these studies. So St. Thomas thus writes this in Question 24, Article 9. The diverse grades of charity are distinguished according to the diverse studies to which a man is led by the growth in charity. For the first study, which is incumbent on a man, is principally to draw back from sin and to resist his concupiscence, which move him contrary to charity. And this pertains to beginners, in whom charity must be nourished and fostered, lest it be corrupted. The second study follows, where a man principally intends that by which he grows in goodness. And this study pertains to the proficient, who principally intend to make charity stronger in themselves. The third study is when a man principally intends to adhere to God and to enjoy him. And this pertains to the perfect, who wish to be dissolved and to be with Christ, Philippians 1:23. So these three studies are arguably the most important studies that a Christian can undertake. because they pertain to how completely a Christian fulfills his or her fundamental vocation, which is defined precisely in terms of charity. As Vatican II taught in Lumen Gentium 40, quote, "All the faithful of Christ, of whatever rank or status, are called to the fullness of the Christian life and to the perfection of charity. No matter how developed you are in your career, in your knowledge, in your physical well-being, the ultimate litmus test for your success as a Christian is in terms of charity. Beginners have to make a study of how to expel sin from within themselves. Those making progress have to study how to grow in charity and all the virtues under its command. These studies having been completed, one can study simply how to enjoy God and how to treasure their union with Him." So we see in question 24, article 9, that study is vital to charity and vital for the moral life. Okay. Second place in the second part of the second part where we can look at study is way further along in question 166, which is on the virtue. Anyone know this off the top of your head? 166, the virtue of studiousness. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's like, I came for a lecture on this. Okay, well, now we're getting to that, okay? Studiositas is the Latin here. So Aquinas is going to throw us a little bit of a curveball in question 166. The virtue of studiousness is not about how smart you are. There can be someone who does really well in school, but might not have studiousness. And there can be someone who just whiffs it when it comes to formal education, and yet they can be a titan of studiousness. Why is this? Well, because there are some virtues that pertain to how well you use your mind to perform different sorts of action pertaining to knowledge and to the truth. These are called the intellectual virtues. Aquinas discusses these in the first part of the second part, question 57. So most intellectual virtues are speculative, okay? They perfect the mind's ability to know things, okay? So the virtue of understanding, intellectus, is the ability to grasp core concepts. We get the idea. We get the principle of things. We get the basic bits of information that we need. The virtue of science, scientia, is the ability to reason with these principles to arrive at new conclusions. The virtue of wisdom, sapientia, allows us to answer that pesky question, why? Okay? The wise person knows how to answer the question, why? Not just once, but many times. They can go to the highest ultimate causes of things. Now, as important as these speculative intellectual virtues are, however, Aquinas is very clear that one can possess these virtues and be a bad person. Okay? So we know from history, from literature and film, it's probably maybe even our personal experiences, that smart people can be jerks. They can be proud and devious. They can be very skilled at rationalizing their bad behavior. They can manipulate others. They can use their mental prowess for evil. Hence, we have these wonderful phrases like evil genius, criminal mastermind, mad scientist, okay? The demons are hyper-intelligent. They are piercing, burning intellect. And yet they're evil. They knowingly rejected God and their own beatitude. And they do all that they can so that we do as well. Why can there be this disconnect between intelligence and goodness? Because there's another set of virtues that serve as the benchmark, not for a person's intellectual capability, but precisely for their moral goodness. And these virtues go by the name of moral virtues. The moral virtues not only involve what we do with our knowledge, but they are what direct all of our actions so as to be good and conducive towards progress, towards beatitude. They do this by one way or another, providing a habit, a durable enhancement for those key motors of the moral life, which are called appetites. Okay, now normally when you think of appetite, we think like, oh, my stomach's growling and I'm hungry. Okay, that is an appetite, but we have many more appetites. Okay, some of them are physical and we feel them. Some of them are spiritual. We don't feel them. Our will, for example, for St. Thomas is our mind's appetite. It's not like the command force center. It's your mind wanting good things. Okay, now we are the sort of thing that is not perfect from the get-go. We have to seek our perfection. We have to seek out those things that lead us to perfection. This seeking capability is called the appetitive power, the appetites. The moral virtues, what do? They perfect that power in its different dimensions in our life, making it so that what we seek is in accord with right reason, and how we seek it is fitting and wise. Now, the virtue of temperance, okay? Temperance in America, when we hear temperance, we think of like not drinking, okay? Chuck that out. The virtue of temperance is a big moral virtue. It is the perfection of our ability to desire. Whoa, okay? So the person who is temperate, they're not just like white-knuckling it all the time. They're not like a stress ball, like, okay? They're not afraid of a good time, okay? A person who has the virtue of temperance freely, easily, and pleasantly desires the goods of the body and the goods of the soul. And they are equally powerful and adroit at repelling desires that are shameful, disordered, and not suited for their physical and spiritual health. The temperate person knows how to moderate their desire so that their desire resonates with and actualizes their deepest and their primordial desire, the desire to be happy. That's a powerful virtue. And depending on the good desired, there are different species of temperance. The right desire for physical foods, for physical goods, such as food, drink, and sex, all have different names. Abstinence, sobriety, chastity. The right desire for spiritual goods, such as excellence and fun, also have different names. Humility and eutropelia. Whoa. Oh, yeah, okay. That's a whole other talk, but eutropelia is where it's at, okay? That's a great virtue. And by the way, so eutropelia, these virtues, they're in between an extreme, okay? Virtue of eutropelia is the person who knows how to seek fun in the right way. And it's opposed between two sins. One sin is that you're a clown, which is that you can't stop, you can't be serious, okay? The other sin is being boring. So, eutropelia, that's a great virtue. Anyway, what about studiousness? Studiousness is a form of temperance that moderates our desire for the spiritual good of knowledge. Studiousness is a form of temperance that moderates our desire for the spiritual good of knowledge. It's not knowledge itself, but the desire for knowledge. It's not doing homework or research, but why you're doing homework and research. While knowledge is good considered by itself, Aquinas recognizes that our desire for it might not be good. He points out that sin can affect our search for knowledge in two big ways, falling under what is called the vice of curiosity. Now, this is not curiosity like I wonder what St. Thomas says about study, okay? That's just part of our desire to know, okay? Curiosity is the vice, the vitiation. It's how our desire for knowledge goes wrong. Just as lust is the vitiation of our desire for sexual pleasure, curiosity is the vitiation of our desire for knowledge. So what are the two ways that curiosity vitiates our knowledge or desire for knowledge? First, when we desire knowledge for the sake of something sinful. Okay? Our pursuit of knowledge becomes a proximate end or means, as it were, for some remote evil end that we have set our heart on. So we can imagine someone who studies economics, business, and finance. Why? In order to accumulate as much treasure on earth for themselves as possible, thus falling into the mortal sin of greed. Or someone who hunts out arcane and trivial knowledge. Why? Simply to feel superior to others, thus lapsing into the mortal sin of pride. Or a thief who studies security systems in order to commit more effective sneak thievery. Our desire for knowledge is vitiated by a vicious end. Second, sin can creep in when our very desire itself for knowledge is warped, is disproportionate, or out of order. Aquinas points to four ways that this can happen. He writes this, quote, first, when a man is withdrawn by a less profitable study from a study that is an obligation incumbent upon him. Hence, Jerome says, we see priests forsaking the Gospels and the prophets and reading stage plays. Second, when a man studies to learn from someone by whom it is unlawful to be taught. As in the case of those who seek to know the future through demons. Okay. By the way, New Age, occult, don't do it. Demons are real. Third, when a man desires to know the truth about creatures without referring his knowledge to its due end, namely the knowledge of God. Fourth, when a man studies to know the truth above the capacity of his own intelligence, since by doing so, we easily fall into error. Wherefore is written in Sirach chapter 3, seek not the things that are too high for you. So, what is studiousness then? Study, writes Aquinas, drawing on Cicero, is the vehement application of the mind to something. When this study, this application of the mind is animated by a desire for a truly good end, when it is commensurate with your responsibilities and your state in life, when you draw from the right teachers and the right sources, when it is complementary to your desire for happiness with God, when you progress in wise sequence, neither jumping too far ahead nor shimmying off course, then you can be said to be studious. Two Cal students can both pursue a BA in history. They can have the same classes, the same grades, and the same career prospects. But one of them might have the virtue of studiousness, and the other might not. The difference is not knowledge, but how their desire for knowledge is integrated into a beatifying life. That's where the virtue of studiousness fits in. Knowledge is not an enemy to the moral life. When we pursue it, when we study it well with the virtue of studiousness, it contributes to our perfection. And it provides us on earth with a real foretaste of our eternal happiness, of seeing the truth face to face in heaven. So the third and final place where we can look at study in the second part of the second part is in question 179. It's towards the end, okay? 189 is the end, so it's like almost at the end. Now, questions 1 to 170 of the second part of the second part, they all have to do with things that every Christian has to do in the moral life. They're all the particulars that go into like every Christian's life. Questions 171 to the end, 189, they examine particular things that apply to some Christians or help to distinguish certain people from one another. One such division, for example, is according to what are called the gratuitous graces that God gives to some people. Okay, for example, prophecy, tongues, working miracles. Another division is according to the various offices and states of life to which some people are called, such as religious life or marriage, being a teacher, being a pastor. These distinctions add the diverse beauty of the church. But there is a third division. The tradition has long looked at the account of the sisters of Martha and Mary, presented in the Gospel of Luke, as being prototypes for every Christian disciple. They provide a template, not just for our little tasks here and there, but for the overarching structure of our entire life. Martha was busy doing what? What was Martha doing? Serving. Okay, is that good? Yes. What was Mary doing? Yes. Okay, good. Yeah. And was that good?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So we're not saying like, you know, Mary good, Martha bad. Okay. So now our life has a definitive shape to it, each one of us. And one of these two women will exemplify our life. St. Augustine, for example, in one of his sermons wrote this: in these two women, the two lives are figured, the life present and the life to come, the life of labor and the life of quiet, the life temporal and the life eternal. These are the two lives. Now, with his typical respect for tradition, Aquinas keeps this division. Mary represents the contemplative life. Martha represents the active life. And for Aquinas, everyone is either one or the other. But what is it that distinguishes a contemplative from an active? There are contemplatives who can be very busy. And there are actives who contemplate. In fact, every Christian should contemplate as part of the natural growth and the virtue of charity. It's the third grade, okay? What makes the difference for Aquinas is what? Anyone guess?
Study.
Oh. Again, this is not study in the sense of like what kind of homework you do, but study in the sense of what are you applying yourself to? What does your exertion drive at? What is it that you are seeking to do in this life? Specifically, the distinction between the active and the contemplative life is about what sort of action stands at the goal of your life's study. See, Thomas writes this: another difference between people is according to diverse lives, namely the active and the contemplative, which are understood according to the diverse studies of operation. For Aquinas, it's black or white. There's no mix. There's no gray. You're either an active or a contemplative, which means that you are oriented either towards doing things or oriented towards knowing things. That orientation is the study of your life, indicative of whether the practical or the speculative intellect is the driving force of your actions. What the active does, including contemplation, is geared towards action. What the contemplative does, including work, is geared towards knowledge. It's not a simple question of time or a certain ratio of how much you do one or the other. The true test for discerning what the study of your life is, Aquinas points out, is ultimately recognizing what good gives you the most delight. What good is most commonly the foundation of your friendships? In question 179, article 1, Aquinas writes this: "The life of every man seems to be that in which he maximally delights, and towards which he maximally intends, and in which he chiefly wishes to associate with a friend." If helping others through public policy galvanizes you, if you go to school because you want to make a difference in society through just laws founded upon noble and true principles, if your friends nerd out about referendums and the latest buzz from Washington, then, my friend, you are a doozy of an active. And that's good. You live to do. And the church needs doers. If you chase the thrill of solving a rarefied physics problem, if you have crafted your diet, exercise, sleep, and social life to make it so that you can bring your A game to research, if your friends can't stop talking about the inaccuracies of the quantum realm and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then you, my friend, are a contemplative. You live to know. And the church needs good knowers. In either case, your life is measured by study. Not these little things here and there, but the overarching study of your life. In following that study, you find your delight, you find your purpose, and you find your friends. So I'll wrap up at this point. So just in this second part of the second part, we can see that study plays a vital role in the moral life. It is ingrained in the development of charity, the beating heart of the Christian life. It perfects your desire for knowledge. It provides a structure for your entire life. When we turn to St. Thomas to learn about study, what do we find? We find that the head and the heart are not dichotomous. We find that knowledge is just not a matter of skill, it's a matter of virtue. We find that what satisfies us is ultimately our true homeland in heaven. And that's ultimately the greatest thing worth studying. When our Lord asked St. Thomas what he wanted, what did St. Thomas say? Non nisi te, Domine, nothing but you. That is our greatest study. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.